We're doing our class on Pirkei Avot in the Jewish home. We're up to the second chapter of Pirkei Avot, the 12th Mishnah, and in some editions this is the 17th Mishnah, Rabbi Yossi Omer. So Rabbi Yossi was the pious one, and Rabbi Yossi had stressed the concept of Gmilut Chesed, of doing kindness with our fellow man. And now Rabbi Yossi instructs us, Yehi Mamon Chavercha Chaviv Alecha Keshelach. Your friend's money should be cherished by you like your own. Your friend's money should be cherished by you like your own. So on the simple level, that's like a guy who walks by and he sees the water's running. And he figures, it's not my water, it's the yeshiva's water. So what? Turn it off. That's the attitude. Why should my friend lose money? Quite the contrary. My friend's money should be as precious to me as my own. On a deeper level, this is the idea of not only his money, but how much more so his strength, his honor, his understanding. If I care for my friend, even about his money, I certainly should care about his health. I certainly should care about his strength, his honor, his understanding. Our sages said that cursed is a person who knows Torah and someone asks him that Torah and he doesn't share it with him. If someone asks you for something that you know, so Chazal held it as a very improper thing to withhold that information. Torah is everyone's. You happen to know something someone else doesn't know, share it with him. It's interesting that this is an area that people sometimes find difficult. Sometimes it takes time to get used to. There was once a couple that as a wedding gift, one of them went to work. And when he got to work, his co-workers got him a box of very, very expensive chocolates. So he left them in the car. And it's a weakness. In general, when it comes to working on our weaknesses, the Rambam tells us the formula is that one is supposed to behave as though he has a trait, and then slowly it will become natural to him. Meaning if a person is going to wait to want to give his friend like himself, it might never happen. But if a person behaves as though he cares about his friend, then we're strong believers in that. That behaving a certain way causes us to be a certain way. Eventually it becomes real. Obviously, we don't say... Now every person should decide they're the gra and stay up till 2 o'clock in the morning learning and then take a nap and at 2:30 start your day learning. Certain things are unrealistic. You can't make believe you're someone who you aren't. But within the realm of what's normal for us, the way to acquire good traits is by behaving as though we have them. So if I couldn't care less about my roommate's things, I should behave as though I could care less. I should behave as though it's important to me. And with time, it will really become important to me. Very often people come from homes or environments where it's a dog-eat-dog world. You can get that feeling sometimes when you sit for a Shabbos meal with people. You take out the bowl of hummus, and you know that if you didn't take a portion within 10 seconds, there's nothing left for you. Oh, so, of course, yeah, in certain places. There are opportunities where a person can take small steps and tell himself, wait a second, what's important to me? And a good way of doing it is, let's say, I know that every month or two we have a student here who undergoes circumcision. Then they're in bed and they can't move. Who's going to bring them lunch? Now the winter's coming. People have flus. People stay in bed. Who's bringing them supper? We have opportunities to illustrate this. I can tell you that when I was a youngster, I once went to yeshiva, and the lunchroom was a 10-minute walk from the dorm. And when there were guys in the dorm who were sick, so I started bringing plates of food to the dorm. And after two or three nights of seeing that I was the only one carrying plates of food to the dorm, I packed my bags and I left. I said, I'm not willing to learn Torah with people who can't care for the sick. If I'm the newcomer in town, and I'm the one schlepping the food to the guys who are sick in the dorm, then there's something sick with this place. I packed my bags and left. And I what? What happened to the guys in the room? I don't know. But where were they when their friends were sick? Meaning, part of a yeshiva is that we help one another. And you could think about it in terms of you're preparing for married life. Married life is about giving. And the sooner a person gets accustomed to giving, the better his life is going to be. Now, yes?
What if people don't care about their own stuff? Like, how are you supposed to react to the person?
You don't have to take care more than they take care of their own. At the same time, we have to know that this is a point that requires a lot of work. And very often it requires overcoming where we came from. About a few years ago, I met with a couple where the husband came from a home where they always reprimanded. Like, they'd constantly be pointing out what someone did wrong. So he was accustomed to that style of talk. And he laid it down. Like, the first meeting we met, he said, I know the problem in our marriage is that I'm always criticizing. That's the home I come from. That's the way I'm used to talking. And I know that's the first problem we have, and I know I have to work on it. Fine. We made a formula. We made a plan. Everything's great. A year later, they're on the brink of divorce. It's not easy to change a trait. And he comes and he says, I don't want to get divorced. And I know that the problem is that I constantly criticize. I'm always pointing out what's wrong. So he's aware of the problem. But we have to know that this concept of caring for the other like myself, be it his money, be it his honor, be it his feelings, be it his understanding, this is a very difficult point. And each of us has our area of weakness. And one of the ways in which a person can conquer this, like all midot, is to take baby steps. A person shouldn't expect to conquer it in a day. But if a person can tell himself, let me twice a day, let me behave as though I have this trait. And after a week or two, let me up it to 3 times a day. And afterwards, to 4 times a day. Slowly, we can conquer this trait. Rabbi Yossi continues and says, "V'atken atzmecha lilmod Torah, and prepare yourself to learn Torah, she'ina yerushalach, because it doesn't come as an inheritance." One of the difficulties in learning Torah is when it comes easy. Very often, the people who are smartest accomplish the least in yeshiva, because they sit in class and they ask the best questions. They grasp the Gemara in a minute, and they feel no need to review it. And because it goes so easy for them, they don't get very far, because they're always doing fine in class without it. And it's only after a few years when they suddenly look back and they see, hey, my friends accomplished A, B, C, and D. I might have been the top of the class all the time, but I didn't accomplish anywhere near them. I had a friend who was like that. He was very, very sharp, very smart, very talented. And he kept on being the top of the class. And at some point, he wanted to learn Chavruta with me. So I said, you know what, I have a Chavruta for the Seder, but maybe let's make a Chavruta for reviewing together. Let's have a Chavruta reviewing Gemara together. So I said to him, I didn't mean to put him on the spot. I said, what Masechta did you learn that we could Chazer together, that we could review together? So he turns all red and he says, there is none. He never finished a Masechta in all his years in yeshiva. He was always doing fine in class, always he was able to answer what everyone else was learning, and he never got anywhere. So we're warned that Torah involves work. There's no inheritance. If your father was a big rabbi, that only means you stand less of a chance to get there. Our sages say God purposely made it so that rabbis' children are not rabbis, so that everyone knows they have a chance. God makes it harder for a rabbi's child to be a rabbi. God makes it like a segula in heaven, that they're not interested in rabbis' children being rabbis. So that when people look, they don't feel like, well, if my father wasn't a rabbi, I don't stand the chance. Quite the contrary. They see that most rabbis' children are not rabbis. So the Mishnah warns us, it's not an inheritance. It's all about work. If you work hard, you get there. You don't work hard, you don't get there. And don't think you can inherit it. B'chol ma'asecha yiyu l'shem shemaim. And all of one's actions should be for the sake of heaven. And this is a point that's quoted in Shulchan Aruch, that a person can live his life in one of two ways. He could have two lives, the life of holiness and then the life of the mundane. When he sits down to eat, it's about his stomach. When he goes to sleep, it's about his body. When he goes to exercise, it's about feeling good and feeling fit. He goes to shower, it's a pleasurable feeling. everything a person does that's mundane can remain mundane, and he could live two separate lives. And the Torah wants us to unite the two. That all of one's actions, even the mundane, are for the sake of heaven. Now, this is something which, again, a person has to take baby steps. And if it's really for the sake of heaven, then it's going to be reflected in how he does it, in a balanced way. In a balanced way. We got to work slowly. Rabbi Shimon Omer, we're up to the next Mishnah, Mishnah Yud Gimed. Rabbi Shimon says, if Ezehil b'kriyat Shema, be careful when it comes to Shema and prayer. A person has to be careful that he shouldn't miss the time of Shema and prayer. And a person has to be careful with them, because these are things that he says often. And when you say something often, it's very easy not to have intent. You know, I know the words by heart. It's interesting. Very often guys over here wonder how people daven so fast. How could they have any intent? And I always tell them, give yourself 3 years and then let's talk. Right now it's new to you, so it's easy. Every word, you have intent. You read it slowly. When you know it by heart and you've said it a few hundred times, then you suddenly find it difficult. That's why Rabbi Shimon says, be careful. And if we could apply this to married life, what is prayer? What are we saying? Hashem, you're one, and you should love Hashem, your God. That's Shema. And then we say Shmona Esrei, which is our conversation with God. Ask the average spouse, when was the last time he meant it when he said, I love you? You say it so many times, do you mean it? So find new ways of saying, just like in Tefillah, we have to find new additions, new things that to make our Tefillah alive. And the person's attitude in prayer, he has to reflect that he's excited over it. And the same thing is true with the home. One of the biggest complaints that couples have is that they've gotten into a routine. It's not exciting anymore. Everything's standard. We already know, we say the same lines, we say the same jokes, we get upset at the same things. Everything's routine. So guys, it's your responsibility to be romantic, to add spice to life. Variety is the spice of life. Add spice to life. When you daven, so just we say that our relationship with Hashem should be reflective of our relationship with our spouse. It's for that reason that our relationship is in the Song of Songs. It's considered, it's compared to a relationship between two lovebirds. So that's not to be consistent. Now here we're touching on a nerve that men don't understand often. That is that to a woman, our attitude is more important than what we do. But before we continue, if we could just maybe turn on the air conditioning, I think people have an easier time keeping their heads up. I guess. Yeah. It's just above you. Up there. Toda Rama. So, very often, men don't get this point. A woman wants to see your attitude. Meaning, what's most important to a woman is to feel that you're excited over her. Are you excited? Are you excited to see her? There was a soldier who went for one night. He went on duty. And he SMS'd his wife on his way back, I can't wait to see you. And she's picking him up at the gasoline station. And as he's walking towards the car, he sees a friend who he hasn't seen in years. So he walks over to the friend, he tells his wife, he forgot to say hello. He says, could you believe he's here? He runs over and hugs him, and how are you? And everything's great. Then he gets into the car. And his wife is not talking to him. And she drives out of the gasoline station, and he's like, what are you so upset about? And she says, nothing, I'll take you home. And he's like, hey, easy, I was just away for one night. But you SMS'd me that you missed me. And then you show up and it's the exact opposite. Us men are very fickle. Yeah, I did miss you. Now he doesn't know what to say. He forgot what he said. Now what's he going to say? Now that could have happened to any of us. We all know that. But this is one of those points where, just like we're taught here in prayer, we have to be excited over it. So a person has to every so often stop and ask himself, look at how lucky I am. The Gemara tells us a story. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai sent his son and he told him Rav Yehuda ben Gerim over there, and I don't remember who the other disciple. Go get a blessing from them. They just left the academy. Go get a blessing. He runs after them, and he says, my dad sent me after you for a blessing. So they start telling him, your house should cave in on you. You shouldn't see a new year. They start giving a whole long list. Comes back to his father. His father asked him what happened. He says, not only didn't they bless me, they cursed me. So his father asked him, what'd they say? He said, well, they said my house should cave in. I shouldn't have a new year. I should have confusion in my house. So his father says, what do you mean? It was all blessings. So he said, what do you mean? What's the blessing and all that? So his father said, what do you mean? Your house should cave in is a reference to this world and the world to come. You should realize that this world is not important. Your house down here should cave in your eyes. That shouldn't be what's important. You should recognize the world to come is what's important. You shouldn't see a new year. That's because the Torah gives us a mitzvah. You should be happy one full year with your new wife. You're newly married. They wish to, you shouldn't have to remarry. Your wife should, you and your wife should have longevity together. You shouldn't have to have a new year, a new full year. You should have confusion in your house. Your house should be filled with little children running all around. You shouldn't be able to put your things down for a second. Everything they said, his father explained to him how it was a blessing. So you finish that gemara and you say, cute. And you say, wait a second, but why couldn't they say it straight? Why'd they have to tell him like that, right? What's the point? So someone once said, I heard it from Rabbi York, but he heard it from someone else, that the idea is that all our blessings in life come with a certain simple baggage. You come to yeshiva, you have to eat yeshiva food. You have to live in yeshiva dorm. You get married, you have to deal with your wife sometimes whining. Your wife sometimes needs more attention than you would want to give her. You have children, they're going to sometimes pour water over your laptop. Sometimes they're going to discover how different things work and don't work and destroy certain things. And sometimes when these annoying little things happen, a person gets carried away with the little annoying aspects of the big blessing, and he forgets the big blessing that's really the main part of what he received. So they blessed him, but they used the terminology to remind him, hey, you're going to be faced with points that are not so comfortable with the blessing. But remember the big picture. In the big picture, it's a blessing. A person's married, and he suddenly has to go with his wife to the waiting room, and he has to go do a million things, and he could be kicking himself. I got so many other things to do. Let him look around at all the other people his age who never got married. A person has kids, and they take up his assets and his time and everything else. Let him look around and see how many people never had kids. Everything we have has its aspect of blessing and its aspect that there are small difficulties that come with it. And one of the problems in marriage is that we get so accustomed to the benefits of being married that we take them for granted. And even Adam, he's only had one day with his wife, and already he's taking her for granted. When God comes to him with claims, he says, God, you know, she told me to eat from it. I trusted her. She gave me the fruit. He's already taking her for granted. And Hashem purposely made it that the human being has great difficulty with loneliness. The verse in Tehillim describes marriage as a person walking into shackles. God says, Motzi asirim bakosherot. God takes out the people from prison only to put them in shackles. So the question is, wait a second, what did you take them out of prison for to put them in shackles? What are the shackles and why did you take them out of prison? Well, marriage is a form of shackles. What are the shackles? The shackles is there's a certain fear. I don't want to be alone my whole life. That's depressing. Wait a second. But that's only if you can't see the beauty in it. Meaning, there are two aspects. There's the love, there's the fear. If you don't see the love, then many people stay in the relationship out of fear. And then some people overcome the fear and they say, to heck with it, there are a lot of good girls out there, I don't need to put up with this. And then they get divorced and then they discover that the next wife ain't going to be any better than the first one. It doesn't work that way. That's not what it's about. But it all starts with lack of appreciation. And lack of appreciation is really the source of lack of appreciation is the fact that we're accustomed to the blessings that come with it. We take them for granted. And a person has to stop and think for a minute. If I were alone, what would this look like? There was once a couple that were on the brink of divorce, they had a few kids, and they were told that there's this rabbi who's brilliant, who saved many marriages, and he gives his counsel for free, and they should go to him. So they come to the meeting with the rabbi, and the rabbi says, I'll meet with you, but you got to go with all the conditions I tell you. So they say, fine. So he says, okay, first condition, every meeting is $500. Wait a second, that's not what we were told. Okay, but they said he could save the marriage, fine. Every meeting they put down $500. Next condition, you guys are ready to get divorced. I understand that. Fine. You, husband, have to rent an apartment and move out. Now, we're going to decide how you divide up the kids. Three nights, which nights do you want? Which nights do you want? Which Shabbos do you want? Which Shabbos do you want? Fine. The husband rents an apartment. They agreed they're going to listen. He rents an apartment. He takes the kids his nights the week. He doesn't know. Now he has to start figuring out how he's going to get back from job, how he's going to make supper, how he's going to make it work. Comes Shabbos, his Shabbos with the kids. It's very difficult. His Shabbos without the kids is even more difficult. And every week they come for sessions and they talk. And the wife, she also, you know, she starts going to neighbors. The Shabbos is when she's all alone. It's pretty lonely. What's it like? People talking. But she realizes this is what it's going to be like when they get divorced. There's more peace and tranquility between the two of them because they meet less often, and when they meet, they each try to help one another. How'd you manage with this? What suppers does this kid like? What lunches does this kid like? And suddenly the husband is doing a whole lot more housework than he ever imagined. He's dealing with his own laundry. He's dealing with his own shopping. He's dealing with all the things the kids need. And he's really worn. By the end of 2 months, he's finished. The wife, she's discovered there's some joy in having her own time, but she's really worn. And the kids, yo-yos back and forth and back and forth. At the end of 3 months, the rabbi has a few thousand of their dollars. You do the math. It's $2,000 a month. Times 3 months, he's got $6,000. And they come to the session at the end of the 3 months, and he says, okay, now you've had a taste of what you guys are asking for. What do you say? So they said, we don't want this. Suddenly they realized what each one was really contributing and what life was like without the other one. Okay, but then how do we work out your differences? But now they had more of an impetus to work it out because they had a taste of what it was like without it. So he said, fine. We have to make arrangements. We have to see what we learn from this. And obviously they sat down and worked out how it's going to work. And then he took the $6,000 and he said, now this money you guys have to use once a month to go out on vacation. Once a month you guys have to go out and have time alone and see where you're holding. Because you know what? If you'd have divorce, you'd be spending much more than this. You'd have to pay alimony. You'd have many more expenses renting your own apartment. Right now you lived in the apartment you both had. It would be much more costly than the money you guys put down here. Now take this money and make sure you have the time once a month to go out and work out your differences. Now, the guy was brilliant. It worked. But at the end of the day, one of the roots of the problems within marriage is that we take it for granted. That's our nature. And so we are reminded over here when it comes to our prayer that our prayer should not be a constant. Oh, I have to go daven again. No. It's a gift. It's a blessing. And every so often a person should stop and look at the gifts that God gives him. I try to make myself, I try to force myself to stop and look at Jerusalem. Hey, we're here. We're in the land of Israel. The first year I was here, I'd wake up every morning and pinch myself to make sure it was real. I couldn't believe I was here. I remember the first year I was here. And I kept telling myself, it's going to wear off, it's going to wear off. Well, it has. Now I'm used to living here. It's a given until I leave to Chutz Arts. Rabbi Shimon tells us we have three times a day where we can start having real appreciation. Our prayer should not be a given. Our prayer, we should enter prayer the way Rabbi Kiva Eiger entered his prayer. Rabbi Kiva Eiger was a genius, rabbi of Europe. He was considered the genius of Europe. And Rabbi Kiva Eiger would start his morning by going to the local hospital, visiting the sick, because he said, I have to remind myself what it's like not to have sight, not to have the capacity to walk. Then I could make the blessing, thank you Hashem for giving me the capacity to walk. When was the last time we thought about it? I try to take advantage. It's not a nice word to say, but every time someone handicapped comes on a bus, I try to force myself to tell myself, wait a second, think about it. You were given a gift that he wasn't. You don't need the wheelchair. You don't need a seeing eye dog. You don't need all the things you see all around you. It's a gift. And so we're reminded, Rabbi Shimon tells us in our prayer, that's an excellent place where we could start in our day. We could start three times a day having appreciation. Prayer shouldn't be something set that I must do. But rather it should be an expression of our pleading, of our expressing our request for God's mercy. The verse says, God is compassionate and merciful. He is long-winded. He is not quick to anger. V'rav chesed, with tremendous kindness. V'nicham ala ra'ah, and he is willing to rescind the bad. Now that's another very important point. We shouldn't be stubborn. Sometimes we're not willing to be nicham ala ra'ah. That's it. That's what we agreed on. That's the way it's going to be. You said you can manage without the cart today, so you manage without the cart today. You said you don't need me to do the shopping. You didn't appreciate last time I did the shopping. So, okay, go fend for yourself. Let me tell you guys what married life looks like. You do the floor, and your wife comes in and says, why didn't you do behind the doors? And you're like, wait a second. I just killed myself doing the whole house. I was wiped, and I did the whole house, so you wouldn't have to. And all you have to say is, why didn't I do behind the doors? And she's like, well, if I have to go around and do behind all the doors, it's not worth anything that what you did. And you're thinking, wait a second, if it's not worth anything, okay, then I won't do it. You go and do the shopping. You come home and she says, that's not the detergent we use. And you're like, I schlepped that all the way from the store. What do you mean? That's the best you can say? What about everything else I got? Okay, fine, but I got to go back and exchange that detergent. What use is it? It's not worth anything. You run up to with this 3-4 times, this happens. Eventually you say, I give up. I can't do anything right. You do the shopping. Tell me how I can help. I'll be out there. I'll carry the bags. But if every time you got to go back anyways, why should I keep doing the shopping? And at some point, the wife wisens up and she says, no, do the shopping. We'll manage with that detergent. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. A person can't be stubborn that way. No. Guys, I'm telling you, hundreds of couples. This is, be ready. You guys are one up on everyone else. When it happens to you, you'll know it's normal.
Are you supposed to make a comment, right?
Go ahead.
So I read Rav Hirsch's book, The Garden of Shalom, right? There's this idea of that there's something wrong, that you just keep on watching yourself. Your wife is at the mirror, and she'll do tikkun on yourself, and eventually she'll be fixed. You never make a comment. Like, a wife makes a comment, and like your job as a man is just completely submit and say, like, it's okay, like, I must have done something wrong, I can't deny it. It's almost like okay for the wife to be completely busy, because like that's our role, is just to completely take everything. And like, I don't think it's okay, I think people have an obligation to find a woman that isn't going to be critical of them, and I think it exists. I think once in a while people become critical of each other, and they're living with each other, people can get on each other's nerves. But I think there's like, we're almost being trained to be pushovers, and I don't really think that's like a meet of being humble. I think it's being a pushover. You know? I don't know. What's you guys? I'm just trying to find a female with meters. You know what I'm saying? Yeah!
I think in defense of that book, he wrote the exact same book, basically. It says the exact same thing.
That's what I figured in the intro, like, women do not read. This is a man's only book. I tell them to create a secret that really they have no intent to
make. The book for women makes up all the
men's faults. I didn't mean to get too sidetracked. I was just building up. I'm sorry.
I'll tell you. Rav Arush and I have a different approach to marriage. In a certain respect, his approach is more realistic than mine. How so? I tell it to you like it is. And when I say it to you like it is, then you apply it like 10 notches less than I said it, and then you're in trouble. He tells it to you like you have to hear it, not like it is. And then you take 10 notches off of what he said, and you're in the right place. So he goes to the extreme. He says, everything's your fault. If he could convince you on 80%, he's okay. I tell you, no, not everything's your fault. And then you take 10 notches off of what I say, and you're in trouble because you're not where you should be. Meaning, that's the nature of the beast. We're all that way. If I'd be smart, I'd probably go his route. But I'm too much of a yek. I'm too straight. So I tell it to you the way I think it really is, which is that not everything is your fault. And